6. Two paradoxes which strike the modern reader as in the highest degree fanciful and ideal, and which suggest to him many reflections, are to be found in the third book of the Republic. First, the great power of music, so much beyond any influence which is experienced by us in modern times, when the art or science has been far more developed, and is found the secret of harmony, as well as of melody. Secondly, the indefinite and almost absolute control which the soul is supposed to exercise over the body. In the first we suspect some degree of exaggeration, such as we may also observe among certain masters of the art, not unknown to us, at the present day. With this natural enthusiasm, which is felt by a few only, there seems to mingle in Plato a sort of Pythagorean reverence for numbers, a numerical proportion to which Aristotle is a stranger. Intervals of sound and number are to him sacred things which have a lore of their own, not dependent on the variations of sense. They rise above sense, and become a connecting link with the world of ideas, but it is evident that Plato is describing what to him appears to be also a fact. The power of a simple and characteristic melody on the impressible mind of the Greek is more than we can easily appreciate. The effect of national airs may bear some comparison with it, and, besides all this, there is a confusion between the harmony of musical notes and the harmony of soul and body, which is so potently inspired by them. The second paradox leads up to some curious and interesting questions. How far can the mind control the body? Is the relation between them one of mutual antagonism, or of mutual harmony? Are they two or one, and is either of them the cause of the other? May we not at times drop the opposition between them, and the mode of describing them, which is so familiar to us, and yet hardly conveys any precise meaning, and try to view this composite creature, man, in a more simple manner? Must we not at any rate admit that there is in human nature a higher and a lower principle, divided by no distinct line, which at times break asunder and take up arms against one another, or again, they are reconciled and move together, either unconsciously in the ordinary work of life, or consciously in the pursuit of some noble aim, to be attained not without an effort, and for which every thought and nerve are strained? And then the body becomes the good friend or ally, or servant or instrument of the mind. And the mind has often a wonderful, and almost superhuman power of banishing disease and weakness and calling out a hidden strength. Reason and the desires, the intellect and the senses are brought into harmony and obedience so as to form a single human being. They are ever parting, ever meeting, and the identity or diversity of their tendencies or operations is for the most part unnoticed by us. When the mind touches the body through the appetites, we acknowledge the responsibility of the one to the other. There is a tendency in us which says drink, there is another which says do not drink, it is not good for you, and we all of us know which is the rightful superior. We are also responsible for our health, although into this sphere there enter some elements of necessity which may be beyond our control. Still, even in the management of health, care and thought, continued over many years, may make us almost free agents, if we do not exact too much of ourselves, and if we acknowledge that all human freedom is limited by the laws of nature and of mind. We are disappointed to find that Plato, in the general condemnation which he passes on the practice of medicine prevailing in his own day, depreciates the effects of diet. He would like to have diseases of a definite character, and capable of receiving a definite treatment. He is afraid of invalidism interfering with the business of life. He does not recognize that time is the great healer both of mental and bodily disorders, and that remedies which are gradual and proceed little by little are safer than those which produce a sudden catastrophe. Neither does he see that there is no way in which the mind can more surely influence the body than by the control of eating and drinking, or any other action or occasion of human life on which the higher freedom of the will can be more simply or truly asserted. 7. Lesser matters of style may be remarked. 1. The affected ignorance of music, which is Plato's way of expressing that he is passing lightly over the subject. 2. The tentative manner in which here, as in the second book, he proceeds with the construction of the state. 3. The description of the state sometimes as a reality, 389d, 416b, and then again as a work of imagination only. These are the arts by which he sustains the reader's interest. 4. Connecting links, or the preparation for the entire expulsion of the poets in Book X. 5. The companion pictures of the lover of litigation and the valetudinarian, the satirical jest about the Maxima fossilides, the manner in which the image of the gold and silver citizens is taken up into the subject, and the argument from the practice of Asclepius, should not escape notice. Book 4, Adimantus said, suppose a person to argue, Socrates, that you make your citizens miserable, and this by their own free will, they are the lords of the city, and yet instead of having, like other men, lands and houses and money of their own, they live as mercenaries, and are always mounting guard, you may add, I replied, that they receive no pay, but only their food, and have no money, to spend on a journey or a mistress. Well, and what answer do you give? My answer is, that our guardians may or may not be the happiest of men. I should not be surprised to find in the long run that they were, but this is not the aim of our constitution, which was designed for the good of the whole, and not of any one part. If I went to a sculptor, and blamed him for having painted the eye, which is the noblest feature of the face, not purple but black, he would reply, the eye must be an eye, and you should look at the statue as a whole. Now I can well imagine a fool's paradise, in which everybody is eating and drinking, clothed in purple and fine linen, and potters lie on sofas, and have the wheel at hand, that they may work a little when they please, and cobblers and all the other classes of estate lose their distinctive character, and estate may get on without cobblers, but when the guardians degenerate into boon companions, then the ruin is complete. Remember that we are not talking of peasants keeping holiday, but of a state in which every man is expected to do his own work. The happiness resides not in this or that class, but in the state as a whole. I have another remark to make. A middle condition is best for artisans. They should have money enough to buy tools, and not enough to be independent of business. And will not the same condition be best for our citizens? If they are poor, they will be mean. If rich, luxurious and lazy, and in neither case contented. But then how will our poorer city be able to go to war against an enemy who has money? There may be a difficulty in fighting against one enemy, against two there will be none. In the first place, the contest will be carried on by trained warriors against well-to-do citizens, and is not a regular athlete an easy match for two stout opponents at least? Suppose also, that before engaging we send ambassadors to one of the two cities, saying, silver and gold we have not, do you help us, and take our share of the spoil, who would fight against the lean, wiry dogs, when they might join with them, in preying upon the fatted sheep? But if many states join their resources, shall we not be in danger? I am amused to hear you use the word state of any, but our own state, they are states, but not a state, many in one. Far in every state there are two hostile nations, rich and poor, which you may set one against the other, but our state, while she remains true to her principles, will be in very deed the mightiest of Hellenic states. To the size of the state there is no limit, but the necessity of unity, it must be neither too large, nor too small to be one. This is a matter of secondary importance, like the principle of transposition which was intimated in the parable of the earth-born men. The meaning there implied was that every man should do that for which he was fitted, and be at one with himself, and then the whole city would be united. But all these things are secondary. If education, which is the great matter, be duly regarded, when the wheel has once been set in motion, the speed is always increasing, and each generation improves upon the preceding. Both in physical and moral qualities, the care of the governors should be directed to preserve music and gymnastic from innovation. Alter the songs of a country, Damon says, and you will soon end by altering its laws. The change appears innocent at first, and begins in play, but the evil soon becomes serious, working secretly upon the characters of individuals, then upon social and commercial relations, and lastly upon the institutions of a state, and there is ruin and confusion everywhere. But if education remains in the established form, there will be no danger. A restorative process will be always going on. The spirit of law and order will raise up what has fallen down, nor will any regulations be needed for the lesser matters of life, rules of deportment or fashions of dress. Like invites like for good or for evil, education will correct deficiencies and supply the power of self-government. Far be it from us to enter into the particulars of legislation. Let the guardians take care of education, and education will take care of all other things. But without education they may patch and mend as they please. They will make no progress, any more than a patient who thinks to cure himself by some favorite remedy, and will not give up his luxurious mode of living. If you tell such persons that they must first alter their habits, then they grow angry. They are charming people, charming, nay, the very reverse. Evidently these gentlemen are not in your good graces, nor the state which is like them, and such states there are which first ordain under penalty of death, that no one shall alter the constitution, and then suffer themselves to be flattered into and out of anything, and he who indulges them, and fawns upon them, is their leader and saviour. Yes, the men are as bad as the states, but do you not admire their cleverness? Nay, some of them are stupid enough to believe what the people tell them, and when all the world is telling a man that he is 6 feet high, and he has no measure, how can he believe anything else? But don't get into a passion to see our statesmen trying their nostrums, and fancying that they can cut off or to blow the hydra like rogueries of mankind is as good as a play. Minute enactments are superfluous in good states, and are useless in bad ones. And now what remains of the work of legislation? Nothing for us. But to Apollo the god of Delphi we leave the ordering of the greatest of all things, that is to say, religion. Only our ancestral deity sitting upon the center and navel of the earth will be trusted by us, if we have any sense, in an affair of such magnitude. No foreign god shall be supreme in our realms. Here, as Socrates would say, let us reflect on what has proceeded. Thus far we have spoken, not of the happiness of the citizens, but only of the well-being of the state. They may be the happiest of men, but our principal aim in founding the state was not to make them happy. They were to be guardians, not holiday-makers. In this pleasant manner is presented to us the famous question both of ancient and modern philosophy, touching the relation of duty to happiness, of right to utility. First duty, then happiness, is the natural order of our moral ideas. The utilitarian principle is valuable as a corrective of error, and shows to us a side of ethics which is apt to be neglected. It may be admitted further that right and utility are coextensive, and that he who makes the happiness of mankind his object has one of the highest and noblest motives of human action. But utility is not the historical basis of morality, nor the aspect in which moral and religious ideas commonly occur to the mind. The greatest happiness of all is, as we believe, the far-off result of the divine government of the universe. The greatest happiness of the individual is certainly to be found in a life of virtue and goodness, but we seem to be more assured of a law of right than we can be of a divine purpose, that all mankind should be saved, and we infer the one from the other. And the greatest happiness of the individual may be the reverse of the greatest happiness in the ordinary sense of the term, and may be realized in a life of pain, or in a voluntary death. Further, the word happiness has several ambiguities. It may mean either pleasure or an ideal life, happiness subjective or objective, in this world or in another, of ourselves only, or of all neighbors, and of all men everywhere. By the modern founder of utilitarianism, the self-regarding and disinterested motives of action are included under the same term, although they are commonly opposed by us as benevolence and self-love. The word happiness has not the definiteness or the sacredness of truth and right. It does not equally appeal to our higher nature, and has not sunk into the conscience of mankind. It is associated too much with the comforts and conveniences of life, too little with the goods of the soul which we desire for their own sake. In a great trial, or danger, or temptation, or in any great and heroic action, it is scarcely thought of. For these reasons, the greatest happiness principle is not the true foundation of ethics, but though not the first principle, it is the second, which is like unto it, and is often of easier application. For the larger part of human actions are neither right nor wrong, except in so far as they tend to the happiness of mankind. C.P. Introd. To Gorgias and Philebus. The same question reappears in politics, whether useful or expedient seems to claim a larger sphere, and to have a greater authority, for concerning political measures, we chiefly ask, how will they affect the happiness of mankind? Yet here too we may observe that, what we term expediency is merely the law of right limited by the conditions of human society. Right and truth are the highest aims of government as well as of individuals, and we ought not to lose sight of them, because we cannot directly enforce them. They appeal to the better mind of nations, and sometimes they are too much for merely temporal interests to resist. They are the watchwords which all men use in matters of public policy, as well as in their private dealings. The peace of Europe may be said to depend upon them. In the most commercial and utilitarian states of society the power of ideas remains, and all the higher class of statesmen have in them something of that idealism which Pericles is said to have gathered from the teaching of Anaxagoras. They recognize that the true leader of men must be above the motives of ambition, and that national character is of greater value than material comfort and prosperity, and this is the order of thought in Plato. First, he expects his citizens to do their duty, and then under favorable circumstances, that is to say, in a well-ordered state, their happiness is assured. That he was far from excluding the modern principle of utility in politics is sufficiently evident from other passages, in which the most beneficial is affirmed to be the most honorable, and also the most sacred. We may note, 1. The manner in which the objection of Adeimantus here is designed to draw out and deepen the argument of Socrates. 2. The conception of a whole as lying at the foundation both of politics and of art, in the latter supplying the only principle of criticism, which, under the various names of harmony, symmetry, measure, proportion, unity, the Greek seems to have applied to works of art. 3. The requirement that the state should be limited in size, after the traditional model of a Greek state, as in the Politics of Aristotle. The fact that the cities of Hellas were small is converted into a principle. 4. The humorous pictures of the lean dogs and the fatted sheep, of the light active boxer upsetting two stout gentlemen at least, of the charming patients who are always making themselves worse, or again, the playful assumption that there is no state but our own, or the grave irony with which the statesman is excused who believes that he is 6 feet high, because he is told so, and having nothing to measure with is to be pardoned for his ignorance. He is too amusing for us to be seriously angry with him. 5. The light and superficial manner in which religion is passed over when provision has been made for two great principles. First, that religion shall be based on the highest conception of the gods. Secondly, that the true national, or Hellenic type shall be maintained. Socrates proceeds, but where amid all this is justice, son of Ariston? Tell me where. Light a candle and search the city, and get your brother and the rest of our friends to help in seeking for her. That won't do, replied Glaucon. You yourself promised to make the search, and talked about the impiety of deserting justice. Well, said, I will lead the way, but do you follow. My notion is, that our state being perfect will contain all the four virtues, wisdom, courage, temperance, justice. If we eliminate the three first, the unknown remainder will be justice. First then, of wisdom, the state which we have called into being, will be wise because politic and policy is one among many kinds of skill, not the skill of the carpenter, or of the worker in metal, or of the husbandman, but the skill of him who advises about the interests of the whole state. Of such a kind is the skill of the guardians, who are a small class in number, far smaller than the blacksmiths, but in them is concentrated the wisdom of the state, and if this small ruling class have wisdom, then the whole state will be wise. Our second virtue is courage, which we have no difficulty in finding in another class, that of soldiers. courage may be defined as a sort of salvation. The never-failing salvation of the opinions which law and education have prescribed concerning dangers. You know the way in which dyers first prepare the white ground, and then lay on the dye of purple, or of any other color. Colors dyed in this way become fixed, and no soap or lye will ever wash them out. Now the ground is education, and the laws are the colors, and if the ground is properly laid, neither the soap of pleasure nor the lye of pain or fear will ever wash them out. This power which preserves right opinion about danger I would ask you to call courage, adding the epithet political or civilized in order to distinguish it from mere animal courage, and from a higher courage which may hereafter be discussed. Two virtues remain, temperance and justice. More than the preceding virtues, temperance suggests the idea of harmony. Some light is thrown upon the nature of this virtue by the popular description of a man as master of himself, which has an absurd sound, because the master is also the servant. The expression really means that the better principle in a man masters the worse. There are in cities whole classes, women, slaves and the like, who correspond to the worse, and a few only to the better, and in our state the former class are held under control by the latter. Now to which of these classes does temperance belong? To both of them, and our state, if any, will be the abode of temperance. And we were right in describing this virtue as a harmony which is diffused through the whole, making the dwellers in the city to be of one mind, and attuning the upper and middle and lower classes like the strings of an instrument, whether you suppose them to differ in wisdom, strength or wealth. And now we are near the spot, let us draw in and surround the cover and watch with all our eyes, lest justice should slip away and escape. Tell me, if you see the thicket move first, nay, I would have you lead. Well then, offer up a prayer and follow. The way is dark and difficult, but we must push on. I begin to see a track. Good news. Why, Glaucon, our dullness of scent is quite ludicrous. While we are straining our eyes into the distance, justice is tumbling out at our feet. We are as bad as people looking for a thing which they have in their hands. Have you forgotten our old principle of the division of labor, or of every man doing his own business, concerning which we spoke at the foundation of the state? What but this was justice? Is there any other virtue remaining which can compete with wisdom and temperance and courage in the scale of political virtue? For everyone having his own is the great object of government, and the great object of trade is that every man should do his own business. Not that there is much harm in a carpenter trying to be a cobbler, or a cobbler transforming himself into a carpenter, but great evil may arise from the cobbler leaving his last, and turning into a guardian or a legislator, or when a single individual is trainer, warrior, legislator, all in one, and this evil is injustice, or every man doing another's business. I do not say that as yet we are in a condition to arrive at a final conclusion, for the definition which we believe to hold good in states has still to be tested by the individual. Having read the large letters, we will now come back to the small. From the two together a brilliant light may be struck out. Socrates proceeds to discover the nature of justice by a method of residues. Each of the first three virtues corresponds to one of the three parts of the soul, and one of the three classes in the state, although the third, temperance, has more of the nature of a harmony than the first two. If there be a fourth virtue, that can only be sought for in the relation of the three parts in the soul, or classes in the state to one another. It is obvious and simple, and for that very reason has not been found out. The modern logician will be inclined to object that ideas cannot be separated like chemical substances, but that they run into one another, and may be only different aspects or names of the same thing. And such in this instance appears to be the case, for the definition here given of justice is verbally the same as one of the definitions of temperance given by Socrates in the Charmides, which however is only provisional, and is afterwards rejected, and so far from justice remaining over when the other virtues are eliminated, the justice and temperance of the Republic can with difficulty be distinguished. Temperance appears to be the virtue of a part only, and one of three. Whereas justice is a universal virtue of the whole soul, yet on the other hand temperance is also described as a sort of harmony, and in this respect is akin to justice. Justice seems to differ from temperance in degree, rather than in kind, whereas temperance is the harmony of discordant elements. Justice is the perfect order by which all natures and classes do their own business, the right man in the right place, the division and cooperation of all the citizens. Justice, again, is a more abstract notion than the other virtues, and therefore, from Plato's point of view, the foundation of them, to which they are referred, and which in idea precedes them, the proposal to omit temperance is a mere trick of style intended to avoid monotony. There is a famous question discussed in one of the earlier dialogues of Plato, whether the virtues are one or many. This receives an answer which is to the effect that there are four cardinal virtues, now for the first time brought together in ethical philosophy, and one supreme over the rest, which is not like Aristotle's conception of universal justice, virtue relative to others, but the whole of virtue relative to the parts. To this universal conception of justice or order in the first education, and in the moral nature of man, the still more universal conception of the good in the second education, and in the sphere of speculative knowledge seems to succeed. Both might be equally described by the terms law, order, harmony, but while the idea of good embraces all time and all existence, the conception of justice is not extended beyond man.